Good afternoon to all guests, fellow alumni, and all various distinguished speakers and chairs. My name is Matthew Cheong, and I'm president of the Sir David Williams Law Society of Wilson College. We are honored today to be joined in by our esteemed speakers, leading and respected in their fields. I'm sure our wonderful chairs will do an incredible job of introducing themselves. So I will now spend some time talking about the society and the event itself. The Sir David Williams Law Society, named after Sir David Williams, who was an eminent legal scholar and second president of Wilson College, is our student-run law society right here at Wilson. Our society's core events include our annual undergraduate moot, which our team just won 2 weeks ago at the Supreme Court in London, as well as the annual Sir David Williams Law Society event, for which all of you are currently here for. This event will be the sixth annual edition of the Sir David Williams Law Society event, with its inaugural edition held in 2019, opened by Lord Collins of Mapesbury. Since then, the event has been an annual opportunity for the Wilson Law community, both past and present members, to gather together to hear discussions by eminent speakers on contemporary legal issues of the current day. This event highlights the value of continuing the tradition of critical discourse and legal scholarship that Sir David Williams himself embodied and championed. It is a space for us to come together as a community, to learn from one another, and to contribute to the broader conversation on legal issues that impact our society as a whole. I'm thrilled to see many familiar faces from College Within here today, as well as many new ones, and I hope that through the panel discussions today, we can continue to build on this legacy of meaningful dialogue. Before I pass the time on to the chairs, I would like to first thank our distinguished speakers for taking the time out of their busy schedule to participate in the various discussions set out today. I would also like to extend my deepest appreciation to Prajakti and Lily from the Development Office, for whom without their assistance, this event would have not been possible. Finally, I would like to thank all the fellows who have lent their valuable expertise towards the planning of the event, Dr. Shmilovitz, Dr. Trinidad, and Dr. Davis. I will now pass the time on to Prajakti, who will comment on some further introductory remarks.
Hello. Thank you, Matthew. I'm Prajakti Kalra. I'm the Research Networks Manager. And I just wanted to welcome you to Wilson College today. This is, as Matthew mentioned, this is the sixth annual Wilson Sir David Williams Law Society event. I was going to say something about the legacy of Sir David Williams, but I think Matthew already did that. But just to mention that he was the president of Wilson College from 1980 to 1992, and he also served as vice chancellor of University of Cambridge, both part-time and then later full-time from 1992 to 96. So his legacy is quite important to us. This is also part of his larger legacy in Cambridge. There are many annual lectures and a number of societies that acknowledge his legacy, and we're part of that large cohort, so to speak. So we at Wilson College are really privileged to have the David Williams Law Society. It's an undergraduate society, so this is, again, an attempt to make sure that the students are involved in organizing events like this. They get to see how things are done behind a curtain, so to speak. And I would like to also extend my thanks to Jamie, who's very key in organizing these panels. Tuba, who's always very helpful. Thank you. Liron is in the room. Jennifer, thank you so much for being part of this. In addition to Sir David Williams' legacy today, we'll also be marking Professor Conor Geertie, who unfortunately passed away last year. And Professor John Norton, who is the Press Fellowship Director and a former Vice President of College, will be saying a few words about him. Conor was I only had a very brief interaction with him last year, and actually he'd promised to be here this year. So this is really, it's a sad moment for me. He was a master's and doctoral student from 1980 onwards in Wilson College, so he had a very close connection with college. Lastly, I have been tasked with saying a little bit something about the current conflict. All I want to say is that this conflict goes to show that we really do need to have discussions about international law. It is important to acknowledge that international law and institutions right now are under severe pressure. And in many ways, what the audience today here, academics in the university and around, can do is contribute in some way to continuing to have this discussion. So I would request everybody to be respectful of each other's views. But yes, please have a free discussion. And let's talk about international law and environmental law. And before I hand over to Tuba, I did want to say that we will be recording the session. We will record the Q&A, but we won't be using that. So in that sense, we'll have Chatham House rules. But we have sought permission from all of you to record the session. We're hoping to make it into a podcast. And if we do, we'll obviously share that with you before we publicize that in any way. We will be taking pictures as well, but we'll take the pictures of the audience from the back, not the front. But if you do have any concerns, please do let Lily wave your hand or Matthew know that you wouldn't want to be in the pictures. With that, I will stop talking. And Tuba, the floor is all yours.
Thank you. So first of all, welcome to this panel. And as you correctly pointed out, we can never really just talk about law as a technical matter. It's about the politics of law that we need to engage with. And I think, therefore, we are in the right setting with the right people here who are happy probably to talk about the politics of law and environmental regulation. The area of climate change is the panel's title. But of course, there is a lot more to be said about what does it actually mean environment? What does it mean nature? What does it mean the oceans, which Surabhi has been looking at for such a long time? How do we understand them in a colonial context, in a decolonial context? How do we understand them not just as a part of the present, but with their own histories, with their own specifications, and with their own futures also? How do we see the future of environmental regulation depends on how we understand environment, how we understand the oceans, how do we understand the climate. And so we'll be talking today, Surabhi will be talking about the oceans broadly, right? Very broadly, exactly. And the politics of it, politics of environment. Avidan, you'll be probably talking about climate migration, and we're just having a nice discussion about it, how it has shifted from climate refugees to climate migration, climate refugees with quotation marks to climate migration, as you will see also in his previously published books. Roisin, you'll be talking more about strategic litigation, if that's correct.
Yes, I'm going to speak a bit about litigation that we've seen internationally and also domestically.
Thank you. So what I will do is I will just introduce already our first speaker and introduce the speakers as they will present. You will probably all already know Professor Surabhi Ranganathan. She's Professor of International Law, Deputy Director of Lauterbach Center for International Law, Fellow of King's College, and so much more. And her work is really fascinating. I love reading it, and I've been a fan of yours for a really long time, about international law and the ocean in its historicity, in understanding the spatial zones, in understanding the specialities. She's been advancing the field, but also looking at it not in a horizontal but also vertical manner, ocean depths and bottoms, global commons, infrastructures, and as said, looking at the colonial undercurrents which have shaped our current understandings of the ocean and the way they shape also the way we imagine the futures. I should probably just mention that Professor Surabhi Ranganathan has recently been awarded the prestigious Max Planck Humboldt Research Award 2025. Congratulations on that. A prize of and this is written explicitly, so I will mention it, €500,000. And she will be working on a project called Ways of World Making, the Global South and the Reimagination of Global Ocean Governance. So we also look forward to hearing the results in a few years. I'll just hand over to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Tuba, for that very generous. You can hear me, right? Yeah, okay. Thanks so much, Tuba, for that very generous introduction. And also thanks to Prajati and Wolfson College for the invitation. So actually, I'm not going to, in my remarks, say very much about the ocean. I'm going to say a little bit, maybe a couple of words about seabed mining. And I'm very happy to come back to the ocean in Q&A. But what I want to do is say some broad things about current geopolitics. I want to talk a bit about energy production, because I think the question of environmental regulation is very hard to dissociate from this question of where is energy, you know, what are the sources for energy production in the present day and going forward. And then I want to say a few things very broadly about the current role of international law, and also what might be some bases or reasons for optimism. So I'm going to be quite critical of international law, but then I'm going to try to close with some degree of optimism, and in a way hand over at that point to the other speakers, because some of the things I might close with are mentions of environmental litigation and also of this emerging category of climate movement as self-determination. Okay, so environmental regulation in the era of climate change, it's very hard to know where to begin. This is a broad topic. But I think it's worth underlining to start with one basic starting point, and that is that climate change is anthropogenic and it is real. Now, on the one hand, that's such a flippant thing to say. The very fact that I'm saying it might have the effect of making us think that we are sitting in a discussion 20 years ago when these things were debated. And even 20 years ago, they weren't that much debated. I mean, one of the things that emerged from the recent advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice, the court, there are things the court said, there are things the court did not say. But one of the things it showed in its review of environmental developments and environmental jurisprudence was that the imperiled state of the Earth's ecosystems has been a subject, has been an object of regulatory concern for a very long time. So in a way, it should be a very dated thing to begin with saying that climate change is real, that it's anthropogenic. And yet, thanks to Trumpists and Trumpist foreign policy, climate denialism is back. And its impacts are felt not only in spectacular terms, in terms of the US withdrawing from the Paris framework, or from, you know, the sort of the dismantling of the finding of the US Environmental Protection Agency that greenhouse gases are actually bad for health. The impacts are also felt in terms of very quiet actions, or much quieter actions that are easy to miss, one of which is the reduction in climate finance budgets in almost all states across the world. So there's been a real sort of ratcheting back of climate action. And I want to dwell on these implications for a couple of minutes, because what Trumpist policy has achieved is, as I said, a global scaling back of climate action instead of ratcheting up the ambition level of the Paris framework. There's now a scramble almost to defend the very little it offers to the most imperiled states and the most imperiled peoples. And this is a very unfortunate development. But also the Trumpist policy does more. So another aspect of it, and it's of course related to the sort of the denial of climate change, has been to renormalize oil as an energy source, undoing years of work building momentum on the energy transition. Not only is Trumpist policy committed to expanding domestic production of oil, but oil has also become the centerpiece of a very militarized U.S. foreign policy. Venezuela is one example of this, and Iran is another. These are two major oil-producing states that until recently were oppositional to the United States. And so through military action, what the U.S. has been securing is its own supply networks and also its ability to manage the global distribution of oil production and supply. Central to US policy here is the concern about achieving, about the impossibility perhaps of achieving a similar kind of geopolitical dominance vis-a-vis renewable energy supply networks. The supply, we know that renewable energy depends very heavily on minerals, what are called critical minerals, and the supply chains of many critical minerals and their refining processes are now tightly controlled by China. And there's, of course, an irony to this. The reason that China invested so much in developing these supply chains and in developing next generation technology is because it had much less access to oil. And so in a way, sort of necessity was the mother of invention. But I do want to also flag that we talk about the energy transition as the answer to a problem. We talk about the sort of the need to move to clean energy, and we talk about renewables as a sort of new hope. But there are ecological considerations at play here too. Renewables are thought of as clean energy sources, but the minerals extraction that they depend upon is anything but clean. Minerals extraction has huge social costs, huge ecological costs, and that makes the question of where minerals are sourced from, where the extraction will take place, where the refining will take place, very urgent one. And you see that it's the sort of question that is being answered in terms of trying to offshore the problem. And so some of the discourse around Greenland or around Ukraine needing to provide critical minerals comes from that, right? These are ways of securing for the US what it needs by placing the problems elsewhere. And this also brings us to the seabed, because the deep seabed is an enormous reservoir of minerals. It has most of the kinds of minerals that are seen as critical minerals today. And increasingly, it's come under sort of scrutiny as a potential sort of site for sourcing mineral supply. It's sort of the focus of attention of different actors, China, the US, European states, India. There's a whole, the number of sort of actors invested in seabed mining are, sort of manifold. One of the reasons why seabed mining attracts attention is because, again, it's a way of putting the problem elsewhere. So the seabed is seen as sort of disconnected from the places where we live. It seems like seabed mining could be the answer to these questions of, well, how do you ensure a regular supply of critical minerals without causing problems of environmental hazard on land? But we also know, and scientific evidence is piling up to show us this, is that seabed mining is extremely hazardous in its own right, that it comes with its own massive social and ecological costs. And it really has sort of potentially terrible effects in terms of climate feedback loops. There's a real question about the kind of carbon release that might happen through seabed mining. But seabed mining has gotten caught up in a sort of interesting regulatory move, which tells us something about where we are now in terms of this question of international law, because we have two separate kinds of maneuvers at the moment, sort of looking at the question of seabed mining. On the one hand, there's a multilateral regime that is sort of underpinned by the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea and administered by the International Seabed Authority. And this is in the middle of sort of hammering out a mining code with the promise that it will somehow, sort of reconcile this question of extraction with the question of environmental protection and with also distributing some of the benefits of seabed mining to all states and not just distributing the costs. All of these are slightly pie-in-the-sky dreams. It's not very clear that this is possible, and there's a massive movement to oppose the work that the Seabed Mining Authority, that the International Seabed Authority is doing, to say that actually what it needs to do is declare a moratorium and spend more time conducting scientific research on the seabed as opposed to sort of furthering extraction. But that the work that was being done both by the Seabed Authority in trying to reconcile these different questions about seabed mining and the work of opposition to it has been outflanked again by a Trumpist move. So last year, Trump signed an executive order that said that the US would basically now sponsor seabed mining in the international seabed unilaterally. And that has meant that the authority has come under extreme pressure, because it's now trying to, but also movements that were opposing the work of the authority have come under extreme pressure, because from, again, trying to ratchet up the ambition of the work of the Seabed Authority on the in the environmental terms, they have now had to sort of confront the fact that a unilateral action might undermine the multilateral regime altogether. So it's very similar to what has happened with the Paris framework, that actually once the hegemon decides to sort of do something much worse, then you sort of fall back to defending the precious little you actually have through international law, as opposed to trying to change things for the better or trying to make the regimes work better. Now, having talked about oil and minerals, let me say just a couple of words about some other potential sources of energy that are sometimes suggested at offering answers to this energy production question, right? So where will we get energy from? One answer we always get is nuclear energy. Nuclear energy is, of course, not new. It's been around for a long time. The International Atomic Energy Agency will celebrate its 70th anniversary next year. And yet, for all the decades, it's been sort of presented as a possible answer to this question of global energy supply. Nuclear energy has never managed to become a prominent source. And this is because there are many different kinds of problems that are just associated with it. One is this question of risk, particularly the vulnerability of nuclear reactors and so on to extreme weather events and changing climatic conditions. And the experience with Fukushima is one example of where this risk did manifest. Another kind of question is about the safe disposal of nuclear wastes. Again, something that is the answers to it are almost always quite terrible. So there's one suggestion about how much of the nuclear waste can be put in the bottom of the sea. And I don't need to tell you how that might have terrible feedback loops again. And then it's also very hard to disentangle in practice nuclear energy from the question of sort of global geopolitics. Iran is, again, a very good example of this. So a lot of what Trump is saying about why they need to attack Iran is this fear about Iran acquiring a nuclear weapon. In fact, Iran has been part of the system of inspections and verifications that is run by the International Atomic Energy Agency for decades, and it's been clear from the work of the agency that for at least 20 years, there's been no evidence that Iran is pursuing nuclear weapons. In 2003, Iran made some commitments to dismantle some of the infrastructure that it had put in place, and since then, it has been enriching nuclear fuel. But enrichment is a tricky thing because a lot of the enrichment goes towards the production of nuclear energy. What Iran is being blamed for is stockpiling too much of the enriched nuclear fuel. But this is, again, not enough evidence that it's actually trying to pursue the nuclear bomb. But it shows you how difficult it is to disentangle these two things. And that is another reason why it's hard to see in this current climate of securitization, of suspicion between states, nuclear energy being seen as a reliable source. Because there's always these concerns that whatever you use for nuclear energy will be diverted towards the production of nuclear weapons. Hydropower is another example. Hydropower is already massively used as a source of energy. It's hard to know how much more scope remains for building yet other dams and, you know, extracting even more from drying and dying rivers than we already do. Ocean thermal energy is mentioned. Ocean thermal energy, again, relies very heavily on minerals, because you need to construct the infrastructure that can be used to extract thermal energy from the oceans. And there are, again, really massive problems here about that have gone unregistered about the kinds of environmental consequences this will produce and what threat ocean thermal energy exploitation offers for marine environments. And there's some wistful expectations of nuclear fusion, the star in a bottle programs that many states are running. And yet this is, again, a little bit pie in the sky at the moment. Now, the reason I've gone on about energy sources is to make a couple of simple points. One is that it's very difficult to disentangle questions around climate change and environmental regulation from questions around energy production. The other is that it's very hard. I think there's a lot of techno-optimism in the air, and we are often told that it's going to take only a couple of very small leaps to reach a point where we no longer have to think about energy as a limited resource. We'll have limitless supplies of energy coming from somewhere, either from renewables or from nuclear fusion or from space mining or whatever. But actually, that's not true. I think we're really looking at a period where we're going to have to really think very carefully about what access we have to resources for energy production. And that brings up the question of what do we intend to produce more energy for? So what are the objectives that are actually driving energy production? And again, here, very bluntly, one kind of objective is sort of capitalistic. Energy is produced for the sake of profit. Another kind of objective, the one that's often stated more, is redistributive. We're often told that more energy production is necessary because we're doing things like electrifying rural households in the third world, which have never had access to electricity. That's sort of the narrativized justification. But when we think about the actual infrastructures for energy production, they're almost always around the pursuit of profit. And this is something to keep in mind. So it is in the context of these issues that I think the law, and my field is international law, so international law does, I think, three kinds of quite disturbing work and that we should keep in mind. One kind of disturbing work is that international law serves as the instrument for some of the geopolitics that I've described here. So it is, of course, through law that supply chains are constructed and secured. Examples of these include investment law. So investment law is dedicated to securing investment contracts against political shocks, such as changes in national policy. We've probably all seen criticisms of the Energy Charter Treaty, which the UK withdrew from last year on the basis that it was actually stopping the UK from pursuing climate action because it required counterposed investment protection with effective climate action. But there are other examples. Trade treaties are an example, and most strikingly, in the very week after Davos and after Mark Carney made that speech about the end of multilateralism and so on, you had sort of Marco Rubio hosting 55 countries, including the UK, in the White House to hammer out a new arrangement on critical minerals, one that would leave out China. But it just shows you that in a way, the treaty form or the form of the investment agreement or the investment contract, these are legal forms, and they're almost always legal forms that are directed towards securing and stabilizing sort of supply chains for raw materials that you need for energy production. A second kind of thing that law does here is the encasement of capitalism. So apart from being an instrument of geopolitics, law is used is also used to stabilize the basic principles of capitalism, and these include profit, competition, and the sort of the normalization of the growth model. And a good example here is regimes that are addressed to the global commons, like the regime for the deep sea bed, which does a lot of work in sort of reducing very large concerns about who seabed minerals belong to, what are the principles on which they should be exploited, what kinds of political economies we can build on seabed minerals and so on, to simple questions of, well, how do you ensure a stable climate for companies to invest money into developing technologies that need to mine seabed minerals. So they do the work of essentially creating a framework where reward is offered to those who are willing to take the risk for seabed mining. And this is quite problematic. The law does a lot of this kind of work in channeling larger questions around redistribution, around solidarity, around the question of degrowth and so forth, into really questions about creating safe environment for capitalist investment. And finally, I think the work that international law does, and I can see Marie-Claire sitting here, so you might have something to say in response to this, is that it does some work in framing the environmental question very narrowly within the parameters of these other things, right? So within the parameters of reduces the environmental question to something that has to work within the given frames of geopolitics and capitalism. And this means that environmental questions often get reduced to two things. One is excessive proceduralization. So we're not really invited to scrutinize what environmental regimes do. We're simply asked to think about whether states are fulfilling certain kinds of procedural obligations within these regimes, such as the obligation to conduct an environmental impact assessment. And that is related to excessive technicalization. So the content of what it means to conduct an environmental impact assessment is sort of heavily technicalized, for instance, and what it leads to is an almost a sort of disaffection or disconnection with the very publics who might be interested in the question of what these regimes do, right? So there's much less, people feel sort of groups, movements, various, sort of environmental publics feel much less able to scrutinize the work that these actors are actually doing. There's much less ability to, so on the one hand, we talk a lot about things like participation and transparency, but on the other hand, the real conditions that would drive effective participation or that would make transparency mean something are missing. And so coming back to how you frame the title of this session, environmental regulation in the era of climate change, I think the problem that we confront in very broad terms is actually less about the directions in which the law can be finessed and much more about how we would work to reintegrate politics into what is already an extensively proceduralized and technicalized law. And here, I think there are three things that we can at least see as promising that are doing some work of repoliticizing repoliticizing environmental regimes and actually building, in that sense, stronger affects. One is climate litigation. So you're going to say more about this. I think there's, of course, things to be said about what courts do or do not say in response to environmental litigation. But I think the bringing of cases is important in itself, because what it's doing is it's repoliticizing a technicalized discourse. It means what it's doing is it's inviting different groups to identify constitute themselves as sort of climate publics of different kinds, from children to older women to groups that are, it's sort of inviting people to assemble in different ways with the sense that they are really the claim holders for environmental matters. And I think that's quite an important sensibility. It's bringing the questions back from did you, you know, sort of comply with this particular kind of very technical standard to what does this mean for me and my, you know, my future? And that's quite important. The other is, I think, this emergence, and this was interestingly something we also saw in the advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice, is the emergence of a redefinition of climate displacement as a form of denied self-determination. I think that link is quite important because one of the problems we've had is, of course, there's no legal status for the category of climate refugee. It doesn't exist as a legal term. It's something that exists discursively, but not legally. But self-determination is an important concept. It's a broad concept. It's a capacious concept. It's also something that is seen as, you know, a species. It's as a jus cogens norm in some discourses. But also to link the problem of climate displacement to the problem of self-determination is to link it to much larger questions of responsibility and historicity. So there's a real question about who is displaced. And we know many of those who are displaced are people who've contributed or historically had the least occasion to contribute to the production of the problem, right? So it brings us back to these larger questions of how can we frame displacement alongside this broader question of reparations. What kinds of forward-looking reparations regimes do we need to construct to account for displacement that has historical causes? And I think that's a sort of emerging powerful discourse that can do some work. And a third is just climate mobilization. And I know climate movements are not always popular. People don't really like things like Just Stop Oil because they see them as, you know, defacing museums and so forth. But I think what we are seeing through these movements, but also movements that are perhaps less disruptive and more about protest and you know, vocal actions, is a real questioning of this, what has so far been seen as a very settled political economy, that we can only talk about climate within the context of a given political economy, to a real questioning and seeing, can the future not be built on different terms? So can we not rethink the question from the ground up in terms of what are the actual ways in which we should understand relations of production and distribution in the world? Movements and their alliances are doing enormous amounts of work at local levels, but also in terms of building regional alliances. And so there's some hope to the extent that movements remain quite a vibrant place. I mean, it's not surprising that we see in many jurisdictions the effort to stamp out environmental climate mobilization, but I think it's probably, if there's a cause for optimism, it's probably resting in the hands of movements. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for this brilliant introduction, where we went all the way from geopolitics to questioning what international law does and questioning its technicality and how we can actually repoliticize this. And I think this is where probably this links quite nicely to what you had in mind, and I think Surapi has already mentioned also, on climate displacement, self-determination, and we have already mentioned also about the climate refugees and migration, even the politics of words, which are so crucial for moving things forward and seeing international law as much more than a technicality. And I will introduce you shortly Professor Avidan Kent. He's a professor of law at the University of East Anglia, the law school's director of research, and founder and convener of the University of East Anglia's International Law Research Group. And he has widely written on, amongst others, on questions of climate refugees, climate migration. And he will be discussing the current international legal framework for climate migration, if I understood correctly. So floor is yours. Yeah.
Thank you very much. So I will speak about climate migration, as Ravi referred to it, as climate displacement. And you mentioned that there is a huge debate about terminology. I'm not going to get anywhere near this debate because it will take us the whole session. So we just refer to it as climate migration, and we can after speak about the terminology if you want. So first of all, what is climate migration? So the simplistic way to explain what climate migration is: the impacts of climate change on communities, on people, on individuals, are causing individuals, communities, people to move, to relocate from their homes, to other locations. Okay, and because of the impacts of climate change, you move from location A to location B. That's climate migration. Now, of course, that's an extremely simplistic way to explain what climate migration is. And in reality, we are speaking about a very wide spectrum of events. On the most extreme side of the spectrum, we have, of course, the Atlantis scenario. Rising sea levels are submerging island nation states. And as a result, the whole nation must move from their homes to another country. That's the most extreme side of the spectrum. Whether this is going to happen or not, it's debatable, but that's something that people are worried about. Other examples, think about the fishermen huts on the shore, on the seashore, and due to rising sea levels and coastal erosion, the hut is falling into the sea, the fisherman is collecting the things and moving 500 meters inland. That's also a form of climate migration. There are, of course, many other forms of climate migration due to extreme weather events. Think about heat waves, about droughts, about storms, and so on and so forth. Events that are making it impossible for people to stay where they are and are forcing them to move to other locations. So that's what climate migration is. Now, how big this phenomenon is? The answer is it's huge, very big. Now, estimates of how many people have already moved or will move by the end of the century are very hectic. Okay, many institutions, the World Bank, researchers try to give us numbers. Methodologically, it's almost impossible to estimate how many people will move, but these numbers are huge. They're speaking about between tens of millions to hundreds of millions by the end of the century. And those of us like me who are old enough to remember the refugee crisis from 10 years ago in Europe, we're speaking about 1 million people. Okay, so you can see in comparison, it's quite significant. It's going to be quite huge. Now, I'm speaking about law, okay, international law. And so the next question is, so what is international law is doing about it or going to do about it? So here the answer is not much. Okay, international law is not doing much about climate migration. If you look at most of the big legal pieces in the world of international law, you will see that we don't have specific answers to what is happening around the world. So, for example, let's look at some of the pieces of international law that you will expect to address climate migration. Let's start with the UNFCCC, the Climate Change Convention. So the convention itself is not mentioning climate migration at all. Starting from 2010, about in the Cancun agreements, we start to see references to climate migration in COP decisions, in decisions that are being made by the member states of the UNFCCC. These are mostly references with no operational instructions. In 2015, in the Paris Agreement, they created some sort of bureaucratic task force to make recommendations, to study it a bit further. Not much happened from this task force, as you can probably imagine. In 2022, 2023, we've seen maybe the most important developments within the UNFCCC. I'll come back to this later on in the context of loss and damage, but not something significant, okay? Don't hold your breath. So not much from the UNFCCC. Now, another piece of international law, which is take us to the debate about terminology a little bit, is a refugee convention. Some will expect the refugee convention to provide us with some answers when it comes to climate migration. And we mentioned before the term climate refugees. Legally, as Robbie said, it's not correct to say, because the convention is not defining people who are affected by climate change as refugees. But when you think about it, it makes sense because of something that we did, people, right? We did to others. They have to flee their homes and seek refuge. So some may expect to find some answers within the refugee convention also to those affected by climate change. However, as I said before, when you look in the convention is protecting only those who are defined as refugees within the convention. And refugees in the convention are those who are persecuted by their states because of reasons such as race, religion, political views, and so on and so forth, not because of the impacts of environmental factors. So long story short, no, this convention, the Refugee Convention, is not of any help also here. Now, this legal hole in international law is extending also to other areas of international law. So, for example, there is the world of the law of statehood, and we have some of the world's leading experts on statehood in Wolfson College, Jamie, and also Tom, who is not here. So here I'm taking you back to the Atlantis scenario that I mentioned before. Think about low-lying states like, for example, Kiribati, okay, the Maldives. If sea levels are continue to go up, it could be that these countries will be submerged. Okay, this is a scientific question. It's not entirely sure whether this is going to happen or not, but the heads of states of these countries are very worried about this scenario. And the question is, in terms of statehood, what happens next? And the answer is, we don't know. It never happened in the history. International law is not addressing these scenarios. But the impacts on these people who have to move are huge. To begin with, if there is no state anymore, let's say that the Kiribati, I hope, pray to God, it's never going to happen, but it is submerged by the sea and the state is gone. If the statehood of Kiribati is also disappearing, what is the nationality of these people now? Are they stateless? And what about all the resources within the maritime jurisdiction of all these countries? It used to be their property, right? Now, taking away. So on the face of it, we have a legal hole here. We don't know what the future is holding in this respect. So as I said, international law is not very directly addressing climate migration, but that's not to say that international law is entirely useless. I'm one of the very few optimistic international lawyers, maybe in this room and maybe generally also, but I do believe that international law is taking positive strides as well. So international law, especially in the last 4 or 5 years, is doing something. Some things are done in order to address climate migration. So to begin with, I told you before that the UNFCCC is not being very useful, but I did say also that in 2022, 2023, some positive steps were taken in the context of loss and damage. And I'm referring here to the establishment of a fund, the Loss and Damage Fund. And in the decisions to establish the fund and also to operationalize the fund, in both of these decisions, climate migration, displacement is explicitly mentioned. So it is accepted that this is part of loss and damage, and therefore there is some sort of, financial, at least, hope in this respect. Now, those of you who are expert in climate change law will tell me, okay, this fund is tiny, there is not much in there, contributions are voluntary, and you are correct. But I'm referring here to baby steps, if you want, small steps, but positive steps in the right direction. Also in human rights law, we see a lot of positive steps in the right direction. I told you before that the Refugee Convention is not covering climate refugees. And why is this important? Because refugees, under the Refugee Convention, their right is to cross a border and to stay in another country legally. That's what we want also for climate migrants, to have the same rights. Now, the Refugee Convention is not giving them this right, but human rights law may. There was a decision about 4 years ago, 2021, the Human Rights Committee, which is some sort of a United Nations tribunal, and they basically said that under extreme conditions, so we are not yet there, but this is again baby steps, because of human rights law, yes, states will have to host those affected by extreme weather events if they can't stay in their countries. Okay, so there are some developments also from the direction of human rights law. Other developments we see also in treaty law. Again, very sporadic developments, not maybe as significant as we would like them to be, but positive steps. For example, 2023, a treaty between Australia and Tuvalu. Tuvalu is a very small Pacific island nation. And in this treaty, they agree on many things with respect to what we just discussed, but also that every year a number of citizens from Tuvalu will be able to move to relocate themselves to Australia. Now, the numbers are very small. We're speaking about 280 a year or 300 a year, but Tuvalu, the entire population, is about 11,000. So small strides, giving them safe pathways out of what is what could be a very troubled place to stay. So that's another positive development. And finally, Surabhi mentioned before the advisory opinion from the last summer. So there were two advisory opinions, one by the ICJ, one by the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. The ICJ advisory opinion, I'm happy to speak about it later on, but I'm actually less satisfied by their address to climate migration. I don't think that said much. They effectively endorsed the decision that I told you about before, the Human Rights Committee decision, but not so much more than that. I think it takes good, strong lawyers such as Surabhi to bring more meaning to this decision. But the Inter-American Court decision, on the other hand, referred to climate migration a lot. And for I'm not going to review the entire decision, but just for example, they mentioned that based on the customary international obligation to prevent climate change, to prevent environmental harm, there is also an obligation to prevent climate migration. And as a result, they also went a bit further than that. They were a bit more specific. They mentioned things like, for example, states are obliged to provide humanitarian visas for those who must cross the border in order to escape the harms of climate change. In the case of internal displacement because of climate change, countries are obliged to provide alternative land for those that were dislocated from their previous location. Other obligations, which may sound obvious to you, but never written on paper in a way, they're obliged to provide them with shelter, with food, with clean water, and resources, and all these kind of things. Again, sounds maybe obvious, but it's good to see a court actually saying that. Now, cynical international lawyers, and while I'm optimistic, I'm also cynical, so I'll put myself in this box as well, will tell you that the Inter-American Court is the leftist bad boy of the world of international law. And the decisions of the Inter-American Courts are not necessarily indicating the direction of international law. And in some cases, especially when it comes to the environment, other tribunals, for example, the European Court of Justice, did not follow what the Inter-American Court said that human rights law means. So again, the impact of this decision is very much remain to be seen. But again, the key point here is baby steps. So with this optimistic note, although pass it on to our chair.
Thanks a lot. And I think this goes directly. I think the ICJ opinion has been now mentioned a few times, and we have looked also at the possibilities, starting here with the structural problems of international law on exploitation, extraction, capitalism, geopolitics. A little bit more hopeful view here.
Yes, we'll try.
And maybe even looking at litigation, some pass forwards from where we are at the moment. So we have Roisin Finnegan, who's barrister at Six Pump Court Chambers in London, and who was actually who was working at the Center for Climate Engagement at Usol previously. I just had a look also through their website. It's very interesting, so do have a look. They have a whole atlas and everything which you have been working on.
Yes, I've worked originally as an intern at the Center for Climate Engagement, and then I came back and worked as an editor of the Climate Law and Climate Atlas.
So do have a look. And previously, Roisin has worked with Amnesty International and Air Center, and has gained experience of strategic litigation before the European Court of Human Rights with them. And you did your LLM here?
I did.
That's correct? Yes. Mm-hmm. So welcome back, and I leave the floor to you.
Thank you so much, Tuba. Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here and to come back to Wolfson. What I'm going to be speaking about is climate litigation and how that can be used as a tool to help drive the net zero transition. Firstly, I think it bears stating that climate litigation is just one way of helping to drive the net zero transition. Of course, we rely on actions of the executive, campaigners, and the legislator to really drive home real impacts. But I think that climate litigation can be useful. And for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to try be as positive as possible. And I'm going to focus on, firstly, some litigation that we've seen internationally in human rights law. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about a case that we've seen in the UK, which has had significant impacts. So turning first to human rights litigation, and this has been mentioned by our panelists, this, I think, is an area where we've seen perhaps the most movement in terms of defining states' obligations with respect to climate change. And this really started with the landmark case of Urgenda, which started in the Netherlands, and this started in 2015, where essentially the Dutch courts held that the Dutch government had a duty of care under Articles 2 and 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights to protect their citizens' right to life and private life with respect to climate change, and that they had to do this by introducing credible emissions reductions. And essentially, the court found that the Dutch government was in breach of these human rights by failing to impact adequate measures. And what they ordered, which was groundbreaking at the time, was for the Dutch government to go away and to commit to reducing their emissions reductions by 25% by 2020 compared to their 1990 baseline levels. And I think the impact of this case was to really raise awareness of the possibility of using litigation and the courts to drive climate action. And it led to a surge in climate litigation that we've seen over the past decade. But most significantly, I think, is the case that's been alluded to by Sarabi before the European Court of Human Rights. And this is the case of Klima Signorinen in Switzerland. And this was a case which came to the courts, and the Grand Chamber of the European Court of Human Rights delivered their judgment in 2024, where the European Court of Human Rights, for the first time, considered that state inaction on climate change can breach Articles 2 and 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights. And in this case, they found that the state had breached Article 8 of the convention by failing to implement adequate emissions reductions as targets and strategies. And this was because the impact climate change was having on the rights of elderly women who had brought that case to the court. And this case was particularly significant because the European Court of Human Rights recognised that climate change demands a unique approach to be taken, and they cannot simply look to previous cases that they've dealt with on environmental law. Causation is more complicated when you're dealing with climate change, but that this won't act as a barrier to responsibility and liability being found in respective states. And crucially, they rejected the so-called drop in the ocean argument that had been advanced by the Swiss government, essentially holding that it's not necessary to attribute the specific actions of a state to a specific climate harm and specific injury. It's sufficient to look at a state's capabilities and to consider whether they've complied with their due diligence obligations in respect of climate change. And how this is to be assessed is by looking at whether states have implemented credible emissions reduction targets, for example, in accordance with science. They will look at the timelines for emissions reductions targets, and it's essentially taking an approach that is backed by science, and that is going to be what courts will be considering. But what the court also recognized is that although states will have obligations, so while states will have discretion and wide discretion to choose the specific measures to achieve climate targets, the implementation of measures is mandatory. So a narrow policy a narrow margin of appreciation when it comes to adopting measures, but a wide margin of appreciation when it comes to choosing the specific policies that states will adopt. Also, what was significant in this case is that the European Court of Human Rights broadened the concept of victim status, and they allowed an environmental NGO to bring the case where they found that the individual Swiss women did not have standing themselves before the court. So the direct impact of this case was that it forced the Swiss government to go away and to revise their climate policies and strategies. But also, we were already seeing the impact of this case being invoked by claimants before national courts. And we saw this recently in January of this year, where in a Greenpeace in the Netherlands, an action was taken against the Dutch government, where they were arguing that the Dutch government had taken insufficient adaptation and mitigation actions in respect of the inhabitants of Bonaire, which is a Dutch overseas territory. And the court essentially found that Article 2 and Article 8 were breached. And again, the government was sent back to revise these adaptation and mitigation policies in light of those breaches of human rights. So again, we can see that human rights can play a clear role in helping to define states' duties on climate change. Looking domestically, I think the most significant case we've seen in respect of climate change and the effects that litigation can have in shaping states' obligations is Finch and Surrey County Council. And this was a case which concerned the grant of planning permission for an onshore oil and gas project in Surrey. And the case essentially revolved around whether downstream greenhouse gas emissions from the oil and gas project could be quantified for the purposes of an environmental impact assessment. And in the UK, like many countries worldwide, if a project is going to have significant direct or indirect effects on the environment, you're required to prepare an environmental impact assessment. But in this case, the developer and the council did not consider that the ultimate effects of extracting oil from a refinery or from the ground, subjecting that oil to a process of refinement, and then the ultimate end use of that oil, they found that that couldn't be quantified for the purposes of an environmental impact assessment, which is, you know, sort of crazy if you think about it. The purpose of extracting oil from the ground is that it will ultimately be used to fuel cars and whatever else. But essentially, the council and the High Court and the Court of Appeal considered that these were not indirect effects capable of quantification, and that the only effects that had to be considered in this case were the environmental impacts of the project itself and the lifetime of the project in the UK. The Supreme Court disagreed and considered that actually, no, these ultimate end use emissions are capable of quantification and must be quantified in order for planning permission to be granted. And in doing so, they found that it doesn't matter where the end use of the oil is, if that is abroad, it doesn't matter who is using that oil or whether the developer knows how, what all of these end uses will be. And they have to make an effort to quantify these indirect effects of the oil and gas project. So this led to the planning permission being quashed for this development, but the impact didn't end there. It also led to the UK government quashing planning permission for the Rosebank oil field off the coast of Scotland, and also for permission for the Whitehaven coal mine being quashed. So these are significant tangible impacts. And as well as that, the decision led to the government introducing guidance for offshore oil and gas projects to help developers and local authorities consider what is an indirect effect when considering environmental impact assessments and these proposals. So these are significant results that climate litigation can bring about, and real-world impact that bringing cases to court can have on not only development, but also on policy. So in sum, I would say that climate litigation can be useful. It is not the be-all and end-all, but it can certainly help to hold governments to account. And I think that we are probably at a new frontier of climate litigation. The ICJ advisory opinion has been mentioned, and I think that there are a lot of significant comments within that opinion which will be used by litigants moving forward, particularly in respect of fossil fuels. I think there's going to be some really interesting developments. And I also think we're going to see further litigation being brought using climate attribution science. Earlier in the year, we saw that climate attribution science was invoked successfully in Germany to link the emissions of a German multinational energy giant to climate harms being affected by a farmer in Peru. So I think we're going to see reliance on that science more and more as we as we move forward. But yeah, that's it from me for now.
Thank you. I think we have received a lot of food for thought here, all the way from geopolitics, extraction, capitalism, the broader context within which we have to look at environment, to the more specific issues on how, what type of litigation counts, what does it need to be based on, and I think another issue which has also come in here is also a lot of something underlying, but which hasn't been necessarily, it has been touched upon, but not necessarily much explored, is the question of securitization and what securitization does and how international law is supposed to engage with that. So the technical aspects have been especially pronounced, but maybe that would be something else to look at. All that said, I really don't want to pose the questions here, but I think there are a lot of questions of where we're coming and which way we're going and how international law is, to some extent, I would almost say at crossroads probably, in inventing, in reinventing. So it has always been reinventing itself, but especially right now, it seems to be so crucial. So I'm just going to open the floor and collect some questions. Yes, please.